Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Nuclear Power Safety and Reliability Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later today, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If you should require assistance during today's conference, you may press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone to speak with an operator. And finally, as a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Now, I'd like to introduce your host for today's conference, Sean Meyer.
Thank you, Daniel. Good afternoon, and good morning to those of you on the West Coast. My name is Sean Meyer with the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And for those of you who don't know, UCS is a national science-based nonprofit organization that does analysis and advocacy on a range of issues, including climate change and energy policy, nuclear weapons, and, of course, the subject of today's call, nuclear power. I should be clear that UCS is neither for nor against nuclear power. And for most of our organization's 40-year history, we have worked very hard to improve the safety and security of nuclear power. Fukushima should serve as a wake-up call here in the United States that a serious nuclear accident at one of the nation's 104 operating reactors could happen. But the good news is there's much that can be done to prevent that and the potentially devastating human, environmental, and economic consequences. And while most of us understand that the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission has sole authority and oversight over the safety of the nation's nuclear plants, we believe strongly that state legislators and other state and local officials have a powerful role and voice on this issue. Protecting your constituents' health and safety is an important role that I'm sure you all take very seriously. Were a nuclear accident to happen in your region or community, you would be on the front lines. So UCS is really focused on engaging with state and local policymakers to get them more engaged and involved and to encourage activity at the state level that makes clear to federal officials, including the NRC, and the Congress, and the President, that we need a healthy debate about nuclear power and its future as the nuclear fleet ages and as we grapple with providing reliable, cleaner sources of electricity for our citizens. So today we will hear from some state legislators who have been active in their state on these issues to learn about some of their activities and how it might be relevant to the issues that you and your colleagues are dealing with in your state. We have a slight change in plans in that California State Senator Sam Blanksley has quite literally been detained in the Senate chamber out in Sacramento, and his lead staffer, Jonathan Changis, who is the senator's policy director, has graciously agreed to step in and provide the senator's remarks. We will then hear from Vermont State Representative Sarah Edwards about some of the longstanding efforts around the Vermont Yankee plant and the recent federal court decision there. And then we'll hear from Missouri State Representative Jeanette Mott Oxford about her work on the state's Callaway plant. And finally, we're going to hear from Illinois State Representative Karen May, who will be talking about some efforts nationally with some national organizations. What we're going to do is we're going to run through all of these remarks, which hopefully will take roughly 30 minutes or so, and then, as Daniel mentioned, we're going to open it up for Q&A. And I think in the interest of time, I'm going to suggest that we dispense with any lengthy introductions of each of the speakers. And so with that, I'd like to turn it directly over to Jonathan Changis, representing Senator Blakesley in California. Jonathan?
Well, thank you very much, Sean. It's very much an honor and a pleasure to be on this call, and I'll jump right into it. As we have very modest background on the senator, he grew up on the central coast of California in San Luis Obispo, which is home to one of our state's active nuclear power plants. He was there and remembers the siting and the development of that plant. He went on to earn a PhD in geophysics and worked for ExxonMobil studying earthquake sciences and for purposes of oil extraction. And so he has very much a rich background in seismic studies from a technical perspective as well as a personal relationship with one of our two operating nuclear power plants. And with that, when we think about California and what the state has tried to do with regards to nuclear power plant policy, it dates back to the 70s, which I'm sure we're all familiar with. In 1976, California adopted specific provisions that in effect had imposed a moratorium on the certification of new nuclear power plants until there was a permanent waste disposal site. And that statute was challenged by two of our in-state utilities that own nuclear power plants and were looking to build more, PG&E and Southern California Edison. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the state statute and ruled that while the Atomic Energy Act clearly identified nuclear radiation safety as the purview of the federal government, it did leave some space for the states to participate and regulate on other aspects, in particular with regard to ratepayer impacts and reliability. And it's within that kind of backdrop established in the late 70s, early 80s that Senator Blakesley went forward with legislation. In 2005, then Assemblymember Blakesley had just been elected to the California legislature, and he introduced a rather unique piece of legislation, AB 1632. And I think it's important to note that the bill really wasn't specific to nuclear power as much as it was for large generating facilities that happened to be of a certain size. It captured the nuclear power plants, but it wasn't specifically a nuclear power plant piece of legislation. But what that bill stated and required was for the California Energy Commission, as part of its energy forecast and assessment, to review the existing body of information out there regarding the potential vulnerability to a major disruption, either by aging or a major seismic event, of a large baseload generation facility, i.e. the nuclear power plants, and include an analysis of the impact a major disruption may have on system reliability and the economy. The bill also required the Energy Commission, in absence of a long-term nuclear waste storage facility, to assess the potential state and local costs and impacts associated with accumulating waste at California's nuclear power plants. And while at first there was pretty strong opposition from the utilities, at the end of the day, this was a bipartisan piece of legislation enjoying broad support from a number of stakeholders, including the utilities. It took a little while to get there, for sure, but it was signed into law. That was in September of 2006. As we rolled into 2007, and I think probably a good point to make the comment that I know Senator Blakesley wanted to make, is that the progress that may have been achieved here in California was definitely a collaborative effort by both state legislators and our state regulators. The Energy Commission, in particular, under Commissioner Jim Boyd, played a very active role in helping raise awareness and push both legislative efforts and regulatory efforts to better understand what the future ratepayer costs may be and what the reliability impacts, and that it was not just legislation by itself, but very much regulators also working closely with our office. To that extent, the Energy Commission was busy trying to compile the study required by AB 1632. At the same time, PG&E was seeking funding to pursue license renewal feasibility. They have operating licenses from the NRC for the Diablo Canyon Power Plant that run through 2024 and 2025, but they were starting to take a look, given the lengthy time that is necessary in some cases to go through the relicensing process. They were starting to look at that as of March 2007. And our Public Utilities Commission, another energy agency at the state level, was also supportive and helpful in that they allowed some ratepayer funding to go forward to pursue a license renewal study, but they required that PG&E incorporate the findings and the recommendations from the Energy Commission regarding the AB 1632 assessment and what potential vulnerability may be for ratepayers and reliability if there was a long-term outage at one of our plants. In July 2007, shortly thereafter, was the first major Japan earthquake that kind of plays into this nuclear power discussion. It was a 6-point earthquake that far exceeded what TEPCO, the Japanese utility, expected at the world's largest nuclear power plant. It was an 8,000 megawatt plant, and it was almost entirely taken offline. We didn't have the same type of problems that you saw with the Fukushima plant as far as a nuclear release. There was some radiation release, but the concerns over whether or not it was safe to operate knocked out and kept it offline for almost 3 years. Six of the seven reactors were still shut down, which had a cumulative cost, I believe, of over $12 billion, costs that had to be incurred, replacement energy that needed to be found, that were borne in part by the utility but also by ratepayers. And so at the time, when Senator Blakesley, then Assemblyman Blakesley, introduced AB 1632, there was a lot of questioning about, is it really necessary? What's the real concern? Are there costs? And people thought at the end of the day it was a no harm, no foul to double check. And then shortly thereafter, you have a major seismic event that proved all those concerns true as far as a disruption in the production of power that did force kind of a scramble to find replacement power. There was some outages for some time that disrupted commerce and manufacturing. And then there was the cost incurred to the ratepayers. And so these aren't inconsequential concerns. And as Senator Blakesley, I think, would say, it's absolutely something that the state has the ability to be concerned about and should be concerned about. As the CEC was continuing to provide its report, this is now in 2008, there was a hearing in which our utility once again assured us that there was no uncertainty with the seismic setting and that additional studies probably weren't necessary, even in the wake of the 2000 earthquake in Japan that greatly exceeded what was supposed to be possible. Mere weeks after PG&E asserted the lack of uncertainty, we discovered a second fault, a major fault that previously had not been considered in any of the seismic analyses. In response to that discovery, Dr. Blakesley introduced another piece of legislation which would have required seismic studies, whereas the first bill simply looked for a review of the existing body of knowledge and some additional recommendations. The second bill, AB 42, actually required seismic studies to be completed to better understand what the seismic setting may be at the power plant. Despite some ongoing opposition from our utilities that there really wasn't any concerns, even though they just found another fault, the legislation passed with, once again, unanimous bipartisan support. Unfortunately, Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed that bill on the basis that the Public Utilities Commission already had the authority. True enough to, I guess, that veto message, even though the legislation was unsuccessful, PG&E did file requesting ratepayer funding to pursue those very studies that we were seeking in AB 42. And that was in January 2010. And they were going through the process trying to figure out what the study should look like and where and when, and that's when Fukushima happened in March 2011. Obviously, once again, like the first earthquake, the 9.0 magnitude earthquake was much stronger than was originally anticipated and believed. In Japan, kind of the world's leading experts as far as earthquake early detection, seismic awareness, they're commonly believed to be the gold standard, and even they were misunderstood the seismic setting, which raised a lot of concerns, obviously, hence the purpose of this call, stateside. It did so for the senator as well. He was flown out to speak before the U.S. Senate on a hearing about lessons to be learned, similar to what we'll probably get from this call. And I think we continue to work now, not just through the legislation. AB 1632 and then later with AB 42 were kind of critical to raising awareness that we needed to be taking additional actions and we need to be preparing for the event that these power plants may be offline and what do those costs look like to the ratepayers and what does it look like as far as the reliable operation of the grid. From that legislative effort, much of the action the last couple of years has really been more within our state agencies, the California Public Utilities Commission, on the basis of determining what ratepayer money should be available to do some of this work, And then with the Energy Commission trying to help scope to make sure that the seismic studies that are being completed are accurate and actually satisfy and can answer some of the questions regarding these plants. And I think while obviously the seismic setting of California is somewhat unique, the partnership and the relationships that we were able to develop with our state agencies, I think that can be extrapolated to other locations, and that while there may be different types of concerns, a disruption from an aging nuclear reactor for whatever reason is going to have both electrical service questions as well as ratepayer costs to replace that lost energy. And it's really been in that arena that we've found a lot of traction and a lot of ability to try and address some of those concerns. And with that, I mean,
thank you, Jonathan.
Happy to answer questions, and there's much more detail and much more to be said, but I will yield the floor.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was fabulous. So we're next going to hear from Representative Sarah Edwards of Vermont. I think many folks may have heard of the ongoing issues around the Vermont Yankee plant, and we're anxious to hear a little bit about that from Sarah and some of the history behind what has been happening in the great state of Vermont.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Representative Sarah Edwards from Vermont, and I do happen to live in the 10-mile emergency zone from the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Station. It is one of the oldest plants in the country. Its license is due up on March 21st of this year. And another point that is interesting is that Entergy had been seeking, it's owned by Entergy Corporation, Entergy had been seeking a new license to go forward for the next 20 years. And shortly after the Fukushima disaster, the NRC granted them the relicense. They relicensed the plant for another 20 years. And it's also interesting to note that we have the same containment as the Mark I. It's the same design as the plant that went down in Japan. Those are just some little bitty context setting, which was of concern to us. We've been implementing legislation around this plant. Certainly, since 2005, we passed some significant legislation. Entergy came to the State House and asked for a 120% uprate. But if that was going to happen, they needed to offload some of the spent fuel into dry casks. So as a state, living up to what we believed was our agreement, in order to let them operate until March 21st, 2012, we allowed them to have enough storage so that they could continue through that date. Otherwise, we would have had the shutdown in 2008. Some of us regret our decision around that. So what's happened lately? We've had a historic week here in the state of Vermont regarding the future of Vermont Yankee. And another question is, are we ever really going to be in charge of our state's energy future? And that remains to be seen because we lost our case. We had a couple of years ago, we did what's called Act 160, and that was an act that stated that our Public Service Board, who is in charge of granting what is called a Certificate of Public Good, which any plant, whether it's merchant or publicly owned, needs to get one before they can continue to operate or to operate initially. But the court shot that down and said that, the legislature had the right to say that the Public Service Board could not go forward without an affirmative vote from both our House and Senate. We held that vote, and the Senate would not allow the Public Service Board to go through with its process, so it voted no. So it never came over to the House because we needed both affirmative from the House and Senate. So the bill died, and Entergy then turned around and sued us because they said we had no right to do that, that it was not in our purview. the case is based on a discussion of safety. So I think that everyone's ears should perk up on this. As you know, in the legislative debate, you often talk about things so that you can get a clearer understanding of what those words mean and in what context and how can you use them. For instance, we had a vertical audit done of our plant, and part of the issues that we found out about there was the fact that Entergy said they did not have any underground pipes carrying radionuclides. 6 weeks later, we had a massive leak of tritium, of radionuclides that were going through underground pipes. So they had told us that they had no such pipes, and then all of a sudden they started leaking shortly after. Another thing that happened was we had a massive cooling tower collapse with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of gallons of water spilling out of the cool. They were not radioactive water. It's just cooling water that just cycles through the system. And so the atmosphere here, after being misinformed by the company and the cooling towers about the pipes and then the cooling tower issue, set a very poor atmosphere from Entergy's perspective. So what they did, they sued us on talking about safety. They went back into the record, looking at people's emails and also taking recordings because of all of our sessions are recorded in every committee. Went back, listened to hundreds and hundreds of tapes, and the word safety came up quite often. I forget how many instances there were. So they're suing us on that basis. And Judge Mirtha, who is the judge who covered the case, agreed with Entergy that we were really discussing safety. What he did not, instead of paying attention to the bill that we passed, he said that the motivation was thoroughly based on that and he could not find evidence of anything else and that what we were doing was using other words like reliability as a cover-up for safety. And so his claim is that 180 members of our House and Senate were motivated by that purely. And so we lost the case. That was one of the points that we lost. We also had required Yankee to come back after 2012 if they wanted to have more dry cask storage. And he also said that we don't have a right to do that. So, but he did say that we could go forward with our certificate process and that the Public Service Board could investigate what we would traditionally call, which we heard in the previous conversation, on reliability, economics, and, environment. So we can still open up the case for that, and there are a couple other things that we have going for us. The state overwhelmingly wants them out. They want them to stop operating. So if this is the war is over on that. We had the vote. So I think some of the issues is if you're interested, I talk about some of the things that we're still going forward with, issues around thermal discharge, the fact that emergency management is underfunded by them, a number of issues. But I think I'll stop there. My cautionary tale here is that be very, very careful how you use the word safety because normally as legislators we assume that we can talk about anything and what matters is what comes out in the final bill. And this is very new for us and we haven't even decided whether we're going to appeal it or not or on what grounds or if we're just going to keep going forward with our own certificate of public good process. So I hope that was fast and understandable, but that's where we're at.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sarah. It's more to come, and I suspect we'll have some questions about where things stand. We are now going to hear from Missouri State Representative Jeanette Mott Oxford, who's been active in her state on things, issues associated with the Callaway plant. And I turn it over to Representative Oxford.
Thank you. And those on the call will get to have a little tour of regional accents today, because I probably sound a little different from the other speakers. And I have a little pause since I'm going to use the word safety here some, and that the last presentation makes me a little frightened about that. I have been pressing about increasing the culture of safety at the Callaway plant for a few years because of the work of a whistleblower here, Larry Crishone. Some of you may be familiar with this case because of the November 10, 2010 issues brief from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and folks can look that up and read it if they would like to know more about it. Basically, on October 21st, 2003, there was a passive reactor shutdown here, and the NRC licensed operators failed to take any action about that to control the nuclear fission reaction for 106 minutes. Mr. Crishone discovered this later, and it would appear that there was either incompetence or dishonesty or both, and that there was a bit of a cover-up about that fact. And Mr. Crishone, there were repercussions against him when he insisted that this become a public discussion or a discussion at his workplace and with the NRC. And there was a court case, a whistleblower court case, and a settlement with Mr. Crishone. I have continued to press on this because it seems to me with Ameren, Missouri, wanting to build a second nuclear plant at Callaway, that before we trust them with a second one, we should get to the bottom of a few things about how they're operating the first one. So I have been writing a lot of letters to the NRC, writing several letters to the NRC. The NRC sent personnel to visit with me in St. Louis on November 8th of 2011 to answer some questions that were in a letter that I'd sent to the chairman of the NRC. One tip I can give you all is if you do ask a question of the NRC, phrase it in terms of is it the NRC's position that rather than opinion that, because my first letter asked them their opinions, and I didn't get a reply. And in the face-to-face meeting, I discovered that if I ask them their position, I have a better chance of getting an answer than if I say your opinion, because the NRC does not have opinions. They have positions. So just a little tip if you're ever in this situation. What I'm pressing for currently about this is that Ameren should, number one, respond to an article that was in the Communicator, which is the professional journal of the Professional Reactor Operator Society. There was an article in the fall 2011 issue describing that October 21st, 2003 incident. It's by Mr. Crishone. It also talks about a June 17th, 2005 passive reactor shutdown. And Ameren should write a reply to that so that there is a public discussion, and if Ameren disagrees with anything that Mr. Crishone says, they should make that a public matter so that we have real transparency about this. And then secondly, I think Ameren should write up an account of the incident and share it with the Institute of Nuclear Power Operators, INPO, so that the industry has a chance to learn lessons from what happened in 2003, and we're always improving the culture of safety within the nuclear power industry. So those are some things that I'm pressing on currently. I did meet with Ameren officials here in my office earlier this month and present those requests of them that they do those two things, and I'm awaiting an answer from them about that. Related to some legislation that I might offer, if anyone has a model for improving whistleblower laws, I would love to see that. And then also I think it's sort of a shame that the cost of whistleblower cases goes into the rate base for Ameren, and I may be offering a bill on that. So that's a little summary of what we've been working on here related to Callaway. I'm real thankful for the help of folks from the Missouri Coalition for the Environment, especially Ed Smith has been helping me, and then also Kay Dry is a constant advisor. Many of you may be familiar with Kay Dry, who I consider to be a national treasure.
Thank you so much, Jeanette. I should just mention to the point that you just made that I'm sort of assuming that there may well be questions that sort of go beyond the time that we have today that folks may want to direct to any one of the speakers today. And I want to suggest that those questions get routed through us. I think you all have our email address, and we can sort of make that connection and get you folks connected so you can answer each other's questions directly. With that, I'd like to introduce our last speaker, and she is State Representative Karen May. Karen has been working closely with the Union of Concerned Scientists over the last few weeks, and Karen has been quite active within several national legislative organizations on matters of nuclear policy. And I'll turn it over to Karen.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your interest in the important issue. I am chair of the Energy and Environment Committee in Illinois, but a new chair of that, but I've been a member for a long time, and part of NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislators Work Group on nuclear safety, well, nuclear issues. And NCSL is really devoted, and one of their strong tenets is states' rights. So I think it's absolutely appropriate that we as state legislators are interested in the issue. So I just wanted to speak briefly that we have put together, after the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators meeting in the Midwest, we put together a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It was rather direct, acknowledging that they had put together a task force with to proceed on implementation. We want them to proceed quickly on the implementation recommendations of their task force that was formed after the Fukushima tragedy. So we want them to act quickly. And then also noting that in Fukushima that they had a lot of rods, they had a lot of energy, the fuel was in pools instead of dry cask. So we have a lot of energy, the fuel rods that are in pools instead of being in dry cask. So that we need to look for a safer way of moving them. We are encouraging them to transport more quickly the fuel to dry cask as soon as possible. And this we learned from Fukushima is a safer way to do it. Then the other point that we made in the letter that we want the NRC to extend their scope of regulation to include and prevent and mitigation of non-design basis severe accidents. Because of our increase of flooding, earthquakes, and hurricanes throughout the U.S., that there is a real risk. And I would mention that just this last week in Illinois, we had a small earthquake in northern Illinois, and that we had a tritium leak at one of our plants in Byron. They weren't right on top of each other, but two things, and I think we're seeing it across the country with these non-design things, just natural flooding, earthquakes, and hurricanes. And then we also ask that that the NRC look at the emergency planning zones, the 10-mile radius around a reactor, because in Fukushima, the U.S. government advised Americans within 50 miles of Fukushima to evacuate. So we're asking them to seriously look at and to change to give us gives a science-based assessment of the population at risk within the 50 miles, not just the 10 miles. So I'm pleased that we had 50 legislators from, I think it was about 17 states all across the country sign on to it. And if anyone would like to, I would still sign on or send an addendum. I would suggest that they call J.R. Tolbert at NCEL. You can look it up online, jrtolbert@ncel.net or 202-744-1006. And just one other thing I wanted to mention was some new information from the NRC. I saw a press release aimed at the Midwest, but the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is determining with plants in Illinois that they are asking, they have a new model for determining seismic risk. And in the Midwest, there was a plant in Illinois. It was, it's Dresden Nuclear Power Plant, 65 miles southeast of Chicago, and then one in Iowa also, the NextEra Energy's Duane Arnold Energy Center near Cedar Rapids, and that they are asking scientists to reassess the seismic risk in this area because they believe that it may have increased. So Exelon is saying that it might take 3 or 5 years to complete these studies, but NRC is suggesting that there may be nuclear upgrades that are necessary. So I think that that is a positive step forward. And I just wanted people to be aware of that recent news story. So the only other thing in Illinois, I think as a result of our decommissioning of the Zion nuclear plant right on Lake Michigan, there have been efforts to lift our moratorium on nuclear, you know, adding 2 nuclear power plants in the state. We already have 11, I think, more than any other state. So I believe that legislators have so far said that they want to know more about moving fuel from the fuel to dry cask, and they want to know some other things before we lift our moratorium. So that is an update from Illinois and an update on what NCEL members especially are doing to stand up for state rights and request action from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Karen. And before we go to Q&A, I just want to just quickly mention that I think, you know, part of what I heard here is that there is a whole range of ways in which you all can have a voice and be active on issues of nuclear power in your state. And we heard very clearly some of the sensitivities around how one does that and the dangers or risks associated with running up against federal preemption. But it's certainly a key message that we want to deliver today, that that you all have a very powerful voice. We have many anecdotes of state legislators and folks at the local and state level who, to put it bluntly, bark loudly and tend to get more responsiveness from our federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So part of the takeaway here is to encourage more barking. So with that, I want to turn to Q&A, and I'm going to ask Daniel to provide those instructions.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you wish to ask a question, please press the star and then the number 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question is later answered, or you wish to remove yourself from the queue for any reason, you may press the pound key to do so. Once again, to ask a question, please press star, then 1. One moment while participants enter the queue. Our first question comes from the line of James Cantwell, a state representative from Massachusetts.
Hi, this is Jim Cantwell. I live some 10 miles from the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in Massachusetts, and I know some of our discussions in our area, our plant has been under review for some 6 years for whether or not it would have another extension of 20 years. Wanted to know from other legislators if there has been an attempt yet to have our federal counterparts make a concerted effort to get some, I'm told, $20 billion that is sitting in an account that already came from ratepayers that was supposed to be for the creation of a nuclear waste storage facility out in Nevada that has not long been abandoned. But I'm told we still have funds there, the $20 billion, and my sense is before we have relicensing of virtually any plant, we should get access to those funds for our states and be able to do the dry cask storage, in my view, right on site where these plants are located and save from transporting this material around. But I'd like to learn from all the people participating whether there's been a concerted effort to try to get the federal government to act in releasing of these funds and what we can do about it if we want to work together.
Anyone want to take a go at that?
Well, this is Karen May, and I would hate to put myself out as someone who knows what has been done in the past on this, but I think that you bring up an excellent point of action that we should be using our power of joining together to try to do that. I, as I've looked at this issue, I think that it is absolutely a good point, and I don't know if anyone from the Union of Concerned Scientists would say if they agree with it or not, but that is another action point that I think we should be considering.
Well, this is Sean Meyer at UCS. I would just add to that that there is a folks may know that just recently, several days ago, the federal Presidential Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future just released their final report, and really this was a two-year presidential directive commission report looking at basically what's called the back end of the fuel cycle and really about what to do about nuclear waste. And what Representative Cantwell was getting at was what's called the Nuclear Waste Fund, which, as he pointed out, ratepayers have been paying into this, and I don't know what the current account amount is, but it is certainly in the billions of dollars. And that money, by federal law, can only be used for the purposes of a long-term geological repository. And of course, the Yucca Mountain Project is all but dead at this point, although Republicans in the U.S. Congress have not yet given up that fight, so it may not be over. But the Blue Ribbon Commission did open this conversation up in that they are suggesting that some of the monies in this fund should be looked at for uses other than a long-term geological repository. So I think there is a – we certainly believe that there needs to be some level of national debate and discussion on this point, certainly from the vantage point of plant operators. They had a deal with the federal government, and the federal government has reneged on that. So there is a ripe conversation to be had about whether or not these monies could be used in different ways for and as Karen mentioned, in ways that might perhaps lead to safer operations today, as opposed to funding for a repository that we might not see in our lifetimes. So I'll leave it at that. And can we go to the next question?
And ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press the star and then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. One moment while participants enter the queue. Our next question comes from the line of Scott Hendrick.
Yes, this is Scott Hendrick. I'm with the National Conference of State Legislatures. I thought I'd just quickly follow up on the last point, and I'd like to thank UCS for having this call. And I just did want to mention Representative Cantwell and other people on the line that NCSL does have a policy with regard to the Nuclear Waste Fund, and we are asking Congress to make sure that that fund is classified as mandatory and not considered part of the regular federal discretionary budget. And so we do have a policy, and it's one of the ways that we're trying to collectively represent the interests of state legislatures with regards to that fund. So I thought I'd mention that as well.
But can you clarify if it specifically could be used as the NCSL position talk about dry cask, the percentage of it?
Yeah, we don't actually mention specifically dry cask. The primary interest of the policy is to make sure that the that the money in the Nuclear Waste Fund is spent towards nuclear waste cleanup. And we specifically advocate not just a repository, but also for finding interim storage. But we don't specifically address the issue of whether that money should be used to promote dry cask storage.
Our next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Tamara Spielvogel, Senior Committee Director.
This is Tamara Spielvogel from NCSL. Not to belabor a point, but just in clarification with our policy, there has been other organizations, though, that have looked at efforts with regards to the Nuclear Waste Fund in terms of additional access for states. The state regulatory commissioners have been very active on that issue and other pieces of the nuclear waste management conversation as well. And like Scott said, our policy speaks more to the facilities, whether it's long-term or interim storage, and ensuring access. There are some funding questions in terms of how the fund is managed with regards to the overall budget that impact whether or not, in terms of when Scott brought up the issue of treating it as mandatory and requiring the government to spend it on the purpose that it was intended for. So there's some budgetary questions here with regards to the fund, as well as the nature in which the fund's money can actually be used in the annual appropriations process.
That's helpful. Thank you, Tamara. Daniel?
At this time, I see no further questions in the conference.
All right. Well, I actually have a question. It sort of cuts to sort of this key issue of sort of where the safety conversation begins and ends, and where the reliability discussion begins and ends. In 2006, UCS issued a report called "Walking a Nuclear Tightrope," and our lead nuclear safety expert, Dave Lockbaum, was the author of that report, and in that, it documented 51 separate year-plus outages at the nation's nuclear power plants over the last many decades. I don't know exactly how far back it went. I do know that 38 of those were had occurred since the Three Mile Island accident. That report found that those shutdowns cost ratepayers and stockholders an estimated $82 billion. And 70% of those outages were, as Dave reported, the result of what he called broad programmatic breakdowns of safety margins at these facilities, to where the safety margins were below or at unacceptable levels. And so how can this sort of report sort of describes or illustrates the link between reliability and safety? And I guess coming back to the experience in Vermont, I wonder how one, a legislator or any policymaker, can be looking at questions of the reliability of power in their state and not factor in safety. So I wonder if any of our speakers have any thoughts on that conundrum, if you will.
This is Representative Sarah Edwards. My world was definitely shaken with that. And wondering if we can future. Because there are times for power collapse, which, by the way, we knew that there were design flaws in that from the very beginning. The plants knew it, and EPO knew it, and yet the powers were allowed to such a point. Some people think it's because of the uprate of the 120%, we still were not allowed to
talk about that, even though the two safety-related, the seismically secure towers were not the ones that collapsed. So what I have to say is that people just need to be very, very careful, because there are some gray areas like that. And the other issue is that your constituents, all they want to talk about is safety. But you, the legislator, are not allowed to discuss that issue. So I think that legislators need training. Those who have nuclear power plants in their areas need training on how to, even when you're talking about safety, about it. And I think we need to develop more expertise around that. That's a discussion that's ongoing here for PG process. It's going to surely occur.
Okay, well, thank you, sir. Anyone else? Daniel, do we have anyone in the queue?
We do have a question in the queue from the line of James Cantwell, State Representative.
And I think this would be something that I'd be interested if the Union of Concerned Scientists would help Vermont, because that clearly a court decision that I do not know anything of, but listening to the representative, I don't see how one could be addressing issues of reliability without the safety going hand in hand. So if there was a decision striking down a statute of the state legislature based upon their relying on some safety and saying that that is exclusively that exclusively goes to the NRC, I think that reliability and safety are hand in hand. So I'd be interested to know what, if anything, Sarah, what Vermont legislators are doing to think about appealing, because that decision, if left unchecked, could have a lot of ramifications across the country.
You couldn't be more on that. I think we're still reeling. Our Attorney General has not decided that we are going to
Sarah, you might be on a cell phone, by the way. I don't know if you're fading in.
Yeah, we're having a bit of a hard time hearing you.
Oh, is this better?
That's better.
Okay, I'm in a hallway. We do not have is here in Vermont. Now to the legislative council, we have staff. So we're a citizen legislature, and I'm not a lawyer either. So we're very challenged here. I think that's why I would like to call from you're having this call. Unfortunately, I don't have the answers today to deal with it, and I think our whole state would benefit from learning. We were advised not to, but you have to be able to mention things in order to not talk about them. And I agree with you. I think it's a gray area, you know, in terms of dealing, for instance, with consider.
We're losing you again, Sarah.
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry. Is that better?
It is now, yeah.
Okay. In terms of the tritium leak, for instance, we tried to keep that to a public health issue. But really and truly, they do cross over. And I think, you know, and ours is a merchant plant. So, but luckily, we still found ways to talk about the reliability. But now I think everything we say is suspect based on the judge's decision. What we talk about is suspect because he ascribed motivation to us that when we talk about reliability, we're really talking about safety. So I'm not sure where we can go from here.
Well,
we're certainly going to keep
exploring this conversation and this discussion, and I appreciate the comments of both of you about the – or several of you of the need to keep it moving forward, because it is – it's very much within your realm to and responsibility to be able to provide reliable power to your citizens and ratepayers.
Yes. Yeah.
If I might add a thought, too, I like the idea of ongoing training and, maybe some kind of a mentor network, because there are, I am the term limited, you know, I'm in my eighth and final year here because of term limits in Missouri. It worries me a little bit about who will press on these issues when I'm gone, because there's not a, you know, a ready network of legislators who are taking this on. So some way for those states who have term limits to keep having a variety of champions available to press forward on these issues is something we might have to give some thought to.
That's a very good suggestion.
Could I, this is Karen, could I just throw out, I would have to go back and find the part of the statute in which Illinois set up its state resident inspector program. But it seems having a resident inspector right at the site, I mean, maybe it's because we have so many nuclear plants, but to say that that's strictly for reliability has got to be kind of crazy.
Just to add to that, Karen, this is Sarah. We do have a resident inspector, but I think the cynicism here about the NRC is so rampant because of just the interaction, and people are very frustrated in my state in general about the NRC,
mm-hmm.
and INPO as well, because one example, as I said, was the were the towers that collapsed. Even the industry does not always honor lessons learned. And as far as we're concerned, the oversight of the NRC is just a barrier to our being able to determine our own energy future. We don't even have a purchase power agreement with Vermont Yankee. We're not even buying power from them after March 21st, 2012. So they are strictly operating here for their purposes, but Vermonters at the moment I'm from having any power over that plant,
mm-hmm.
and we're fine without taking their power.
This is Jonathan Changus on behalf of Senator Blakes again, and this question of how you differentiate between reliability versus safety was the very core issue at the original piece of legislation, AB 1632, and there was some specific languaging that the senator drafted that helped facilitate that. A, I think the issue of reliability also transcends beyond just a nuclear power plant. There are questions regarding reliability if any large power plant should be knocked offline for an extended period of duration, and it was from that approach that he crafted AB 1632. I'll be honest, the bill language was not specific to nuclear power. It doesn't say nuclear power plants and what should happen if there's a delayed outage at one of those. It was installed capacity of 1,700 megawatts, which is a very large power plant, and it happens to be that only the two nuclear power plants met that definition. And it wasn't there's no talk about safety whatsoever in the bill. It really is totally focused on if you have a large power plant that goes offline, that goes dark, and is offline for a significant period of time, that is going to cause your grid operators significant challenges as far as maintaining reliable electrical service. And there are federal reliability standards, and in California we have something known as the independent system operator, who instead of the utilities, at least the investor-owned utilities, manages the grid, and they study and develop contingencies in case certain generation facilities or transmission infrastructure should be offline. Where would they reroute power from? And so some of the questions we've asked is if something were to happen, whatever, terrorist attack, whether it was an earthquake, whether it was an aging infrastructure, whatever the cause, if there was a prolonged outage at one of these facilities, where would you get the other power from? And it's not the same. We have two power plants, San Onofre and Diablo Canyon. Diablo Canyon is located on the Central Coast, not close to any major load or population center, whereas San Onofre is in the heart of the Los Angeles basin. And so you take out Diablo Canyon and perhaps you can reroute power from some other place. You still have to pay for that replacement power. If San Onofre was to go down, then you have a significant energy crisis. For whatever reason it's taken out, you have an energy crisis in which they may not have the sufficient infrastructure to reroute power in. And so those are electrical grid operation questions. Those are who's going to pay then to get that replacement, non-contracted replacement power on the spot market, and how much and how long are they going to have to pay for that? And that was the Japanese experience, in which they had to dust off some old oil and gas-fired plants that had been shuttered for years and fire them back up. That's replacement fuel. That's replacement operation costs. All those are legitimate questions and concerns that really don't speak to the safety bits. I don't know how that might apply in a place like Vermont, where the Vermont ratepayers themselves, it doesn't sound like we'll be utilizing any of the energy, but it might be applicable in other locations.
It might be. This is Sarah from Vermont, but like you said, unfortunately in our case, and the other, we do have these reliability, you know, if it shuts down, but unfortunately it's been fairly reliable. But we're just, you know, we're more concerned about going forward with this plant. And another fact that I would just like to relate, it's our understanding that no plant of this vintage anywhere in the world has lasted longer than 47 years. My thinking is that this plant will cease to operate due to economic conditions and due to capital outlays that are going to happen very soon. And so I think we'll go through one more outage, one more refueling, and then they'll probably call it quits. Also, I'd like you to keep in mind how important the case was to the industry. If states cut the power, very threatening to the industry to have a say whether a plant can continue to operate. They were desperate to win this case, and as an industry, they were desperate to win this case. I think you all probably know my feelings on plant by now. I haven't been exactly hiding it.
Well, but this case is, this is important for any state legislature on any issue, though, because, I think maybe NCSL should care about it, too. For them to count safety, the fact that any legislator or anyone testifying are making remarks, I mean, you're supposed to judge a bill on its merit. We can say anything. I mean, this type of a precedent-setting decision could mean that anyone who wanted to have the subsequent court rule on it, they could plant some of this stuff in debate. I mean, it's really horrific.
It's horrific.
Invalidate the law.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really is scary, because anyone could stand up and, I mean, they're not now. I mean, legislators decide for any one of 20 reasons why to vote for a bill or something. You know, they might be totally mistaken. To base law on that, I mean, on opinion or something that could be thrown into debate, is wrong.
Wrong. It's a wrong decision.
And Jonathan, this kind of thing never came up during AB 1632?
Oh, no, it absolutely came up. That's why we had to be very specific in crafting the language. It's why we don't mention nuclear power plants. We have a general statement that happens to describe the nuclear power plants. We don't talk about safety whatsoever. It came up in numerous committee discussions about,
yes,
you know, federal. That was the basis of the opposition from the utilities, is that this was preempted. And
okay. We
scaled it back to say, A, this is a study, a review of existing studies to make recommendations,
yeah,
because the utilities were preparing to file with our Public Utilities Commission to receive some funding for relicensing activities. And so that was the other piece in which California had a bit, and I don't know if it's the case other places, they were seeking $85 million just to do the permitting necessary to relicense. And that's been held up and I think stopped now, so that the state is not going to fund the relicensing activities until the seismic studies are complete. But that took a while.
This is Sarah. May I ask a question?
Sure.
Are you a merchant? Are your plants merchant or public utilities?
Investor-owned. Merchant.
Okay.
They're both owned by. They're not independent power producers. They're not. They're utility-owned generators.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we have gone beyond our hour, and I want to respect people's time. I think this has been a fabulous conversation, and I know just from just the last few minutes that there's a tremendous amount of interest in how to move this very conversation forward, and how to sort of take the lessons learned from the work in states like California and Vermont and apply it elsewhere. And we at the Union of Concerned Scientists very much hope that we can continue to play this kind of convening role in these discussions, and certainly have every intention of circling back with a number of you folks on the call. I've talked to a number of you directly about ways in which we can collaborate and just sort of keep these kinds of discussions going, either one-on-one or in forums such as this. So I really do encourage folks to be back in touch with us. I think you all have certainly my email address from invites that have gone out, and I hope we can stay in touch. And I thank all of our speakers for taking the time and to be with us, and appreciate everyone else spending the hour with us. And with that, we'll say goodbye.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance in today's conference. This does conclude today's program, and you may now disconnect. Have a nice day.